Hello. In recent audio clips, we've been talking about the inherent problems with federalism, and we've been also talking about the inherent problems with having a Senate in the American political system. And you could say that talking about federalism and talking about the Senate are two sides of the same coin, because the Senate is actually like the most overt manifestation of federalism in the American political system. So we've been talking about both things, and I hope that to some extent we've been able to share how terrible the concept of federalism is in the long term, because it's inherently flawed, and by consequence how terrible it is to have a Senate within the American political system. So the purpose of these audio clips is not just to criticize the current state of things and say how bad they are and how terrible and this, that, and the other. The intent is not only to destroy the current system, you could say, but to build a new system. So when we are talking negatively about what's going on right now, it is intended to point out what we're doing wrong, so that we can then go ahead and build a new house that doesn't have the same fundamental flaws that the current house has. So, aside from doing a destructive work, we also want to focus on constructive work. What specific things can we do to replace the current system, the current state of things? So, in that light, it's important for us to talk about what needs to be done to replace federalism. In other words, okay, federalism is bad. Let's say we all agree on that. The Senate is a terrible idea. Let's get rid of federalism and let's get rid of the Senate. But if we do that, if we get rid of federalism and the Senate, then the question becomes, what do we replace it with? What specific things do we put into the system in place of federalism or the Senate? So that was the original intent of this audio clip, to talk about what to replace federalism in the Senate with. But as I was thinking about what would be said in this clip, it became clearer and clearer to me that if we could just go ahead and share the replacement solution or alternative for federalism, if you listen to the solution in the context of the current political system, it's going to the solution is actually going to sound worse than the current problem. And because everything we say will be seen in terms of how the system works right now, and I would agree that if you try to implement the ideas that we would share with the current system in place, or using kind of fragments of the current system, then the solution is actually worse than the problem. So we might as well just stay with federalism and the Senate. So before we can really talk about the solution or the replacement for federalism, we need to talk about how, under a new American political system, the legislative process would be defined. We need to redo the whole legislative process from the ground up, and undo a lot of the foolish things that the founding fathers put into the constitutional system. And I know that I keep harping on the mistakes the founding fathers did, because it's important for conservatives to finally stop deifying these people and deifying a document that is definitely not divinely inspired, and has so many flaws that have us where we are right now. And that's why sometimes I say these things, and I talk about how foolish the founding fathers were, and how lacking in understanding they were. Because if that offends you, and especially if you're a conservative Christian, you have to remember, you conservative Christian, in your Bible, there's a commandment, and I believe it's the first commandment, that says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." So the moment you start idolizing the founding fathers, the Constitution, the flag, and all these things, you are violating the first commandment of your own God and your own Bible. So if you take offense and the things I'm saying, be reminded that your own faith is denouncing you for idolizing people who are human, who had many good qualities, who were flawed, had many good intentions, but that were not perfect, and that left us many things that we have to correct, so that we can fulfill many of the things they wished would happen. They just had, in many ways, a lot of flawed ideas about how to reach the destination that, in many ways, we agree with them about. So, we need to redefine the legislative process first. And so then my intention became, okay, let's do an audio clip talking about how the legislative process would need to be redefined, so that then we can talk about how removing federalism can be done in a good way. But before I could start thinking about how to talk about that, some interesting news came out this past week, shortly after the last audio clip we recorded on federalism and the Senate. And it was a piece of news that when I saw it, you know, in the headlines, kind of drew my attention. I said, wow, interesting that this came out just this week, right after the audio recordings, and I know it's not a coincidence. And if I tell you what the news were, you would say, or if you saw the news, if any of you saw the news, you might be inclined to think, oh, well, this seems to be proof that whatever that audio clip was saying, that previous audio clip, was not true. It's like, this is like a contradiction. This proves that all the bad things that were being said about federalism and the Senate are not true, and that the founding fathers were right and all that. So when I saw these news, this headline, I said, well, we need to talk about this, because as it turns out, instead of being proof that we are on the wrong path when we talk about how bad federalism and the Senate are, that piece of news is actually a reinforcement and a validation of everything we've been saying, even though it looks like the opposite on the surface. And I felt the need that, because this was not a coincidence that this happened, that this was like destined to be talked about, so that we could show even more clearly why federalism and the Senate are such terrible ideas. So that's what we'll be talking about in this audio clip. And in future audio clips, we'll be talking about the other two things, you know, how to redefine the legislative process, and then what concrete things can be done when replacing federalism and taking out the Senate from the legislative system. So I'm not sure if we'll be able to talk about these news from last week in just one audio clip. We might have to talk about the whole thing in two audio clips, so we'll see how it goes. So before, you know, talking about the actual headline that drew my attention last week, let's talk first about the backdrop of the headline. And one of the reasons for doing this is that I have no idea when you're listening to this audio clip. You could be listening to it tomorrow, or, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if this audio clip's still circulating, and you might not be aware of all the details of what was happening at the moment in history, you could say, when this recording was done. So the backdrop of this headline is what happened in the 2020 elections in America, in the U.S. Many of you know, who are listening to this audio clip, a lot of irregularities happened during the 2020 election. You could feel it as you were following the numbers, you know, that night of the election and in the days afterwards, that something weird was going on. I don't recall, I could be wrong on this, but I don't remember a time when voting was stopped midway through the night, and then restarted the next morning, the way it was done this time. Some weird things were happening, and election numbers that were in a certain direction at midnight were, you know, completely turned around the next morning, as if magically, you know, the numbers had switched. Things that had never seen in American history, and I've followed elections ever since I was a kid. American elections, I had never seen anything like it. Everything had always been relatively transparent. You know, certain pockets of corruption, as always, Chicago and some other places. But other than that, everything had always been very straightforward. The exit polls tended to be relatively consistent with the actual numbers, and we would get the results, you know, that same night, and we would see the pattern, you know, live of the numbers, and everything just seemed more or less, you know, like first world elections. But this time it felt very third worldish, you know, the type of things that you would see in third world backward countries like Venezuela and Mexico and places like that, that have a history of corruption. And so things were happening. So even if you don't believe that the election was stolen, you have to admit, if you have any fiber of intellectual honesty in you, that some weird things were happening. You know, the story about the van that the van that was loading ballots through a back door in, I think it was in Michigan, I forget the exact state, and also the USPS driver who took some ballots from New York to Michigan, or one of those states, I believe, Minnesota or Michigan, I forget. And he testified that he didn't know why he was being sent to that state with his cargo, and it turned out to be ballots that were delivered to this voting center. So why would ballots from New York be sent to another state, another state's voting place? Very weird things were happening. So that's the backdrop. And as you know, the ambiguity continued up until January 6th, 2021, when the Electoral College was supposed to go to Washington and do the official voting so that there'd be, you know, an official result and election result. And so people were hoping that, you know, something would happen and that the irregularities would be addressed, exposed, and that what seemed to be a stolen election would not just, you know, go ahead as if nothing had happened. And as many of you may recall, on January 6th, a lot of people went to Washington, D.C. to protest in front of Capitol Hill. And the First Amendment says that it talks about the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So the people who were in front of Capitol Hill had every right to be there. And we'll talk about that phrase in the First Amendment about the petition for a redress of grievances, which is, even though it is a good thing that it was put there, it's also a very terrible thing because it left so many gaps there. We'll talk about that in a future audio clip, and we'll refer to a decision in 1984 by the Supreme Court regarding this issue, this phrase in the First Amendment that shows how foolish it was for the writers, the founding fathers, to just write that and not say anything else after that. It's an empty statement. It really is an empty right. But we'll talk about that later. But at least the founding fathers had the kindness to let us know that we had the right to petition the government. In other words, we have the right to complain, even if nothing is going to be done about it. Even though the Constitution doesn't really give any bones or any actual meat to this statement, at least it gives us the right to vent our frustration. Even though it's not going to, even if it falls on deaf ears, we have the right to vent our frustration. And that's what happened on January 6th. All these people gathered in front of Capitol Hill to protest, to tell Congress, hey, you're about to validate this Electoral College vote, and we don't think that the elections were fair or run in a correct way, and we want you to do something about it. And unfortunately, amongst the people who went to Washington to peaceably demonstrate or peaceably speak, there were some troublemakers inserted into the bunch. And it's been kind of coming out that a lot of them were actually leftists, Antifa people who were embedded into the crowd to cause trouble. And it was very deliberate. And yes, maybe some of the people who went there who were upset about the election, some of them were also troublemakers, but there were also leftists inside that crowd that were inserted because they wanted to create an opportunity, an excuse to, to again demonize their political opponents. So, there's also evidence that the police inside Capitol Hill, the guards were letting certain people inside Capitol Hill. They were opening the doors to these people who then started running rampant inside Capitol Hill. So it's not as if these people just stormed the Bastille and entered Capitol Hill. They were being let in on purpose. And there was a certain deliberate intent for things to escalate in some way, shape, or form in order to then use that as an excuse to silence the opposition. But and as some of you may also know, Trump actually asked for more police force. You know, prior to January 6th, knowing that people were going to gather to protest, he wanted more police presence to make sure nothing would happen. If I'm not mistaken, it was Stretch Pelosi and Chuckie Schumer, amongst others, who said, no, we don't want more police. I'm not sure if they were the only ones who had the authority to deny that petition, or if it was other people in D.C. proper who had, the authority to extend or increase the number of police presence around Capitol Hill. But regardless, the Democrats decided not to have more police despite Trump's request. And unfortunately, Trump, being the naive fool that he was, did not say, okay, you don't want to put police in, I'm the commander-in-chief, I'll bring troops in. He could have done that, but I'm sure that because he was always stupidly listening to the advice of idiots like Jared and that little idiot wife of his, I'm pretty sure that their advice and the advice of other people said, no, you don't want to look like a tyrant bringing in troops. And obviously Trump idiotically listened to them, and he did nothing about it, having the power to do it anyway. But regardless, it was all a big show that the Democrats were trying to set up. And we know the story about this lady who was brutally murdered by a policeman. She could have, I don't remember her name, I think it was Ashley Babbitt or something to that effect, and I really apologize if I have the name wrong, but this lady who was there protesting and not doing anything violent, this was one example of actual police brutality. I mean, we've been talking, people keep talking about police brutality all the time. This was an actual example of it, and to this day, I think nothing has been done, and Trump, I have never heard him really complain about what happened to that woman. If I were in his position, I would be outraged every single day talking about that, and harping on that, because it is unfair that this woman was murdered in such a tragic way. But the thing is that, so this was the backdrop, this January 6th protest, and then some bad things happened. And then this was portrayed as, Trump inciting violence and all this other stuff that Democrats always do to try to demonize the opposition. So while all of this was going on outside, inside, the Congress had the authority, to validate or invalidate the voting of the Electoral College. And we had Miguelito Pence, and that's what I call him, that bastard traitor that Trump idiotically chose as his vice president in 2016. And people who know me know that from the moment he chose that bastard, I knew that guy was a traitor and a poser. That's what he was, a traitor and a poser. And I don't care if he went to church 7 days a week and with a Bible under his arm, that man was a bastard and a traitor from day one, and Trump idiotically chose him. So that, you know, on January 6th, that idiot Miguelito Pence would be there as president of the Senate, because he was the vice president, quote unquote, and he had the authority to reject the results of you know, the Electoral College voting, but he chose not to. Coward and traitor that he is, worthless little bastard. So there went, you know, a chance for the Senate to invalidate the voting, and people don't know that it wasn't just Miguelito Pence, you know, saying no to the voting. There were a lot of other things that had to happen, and it was there's a process that was set up because of what happened in 1876. Many people are not aware of this, that in 1876 there was this very contested election between Rutherford B. Hayes and another fellow whose name I don't remember, and I think it was Tim something, I could be wrong, but it was very close, and it was hell on earth until finally they ended up voting in Rutherford B. Hayes, who was not that great of a president anyway. But the thing is that there was a process set up because of all that mess that happened that year, and that would have been the process that would have been followed this time around. So it has to do with the Senate rejecting the vote, the House would have to reject it as well, and then they'd have to decide on how to deal with the electoral vote being nullified. And in the midst of all that, many people don't know this, that, for example, the Senate had a vote on a motion to challenge the Pennsylvania electoral vote that same day on January 6th. And the Senate, they always kind of vote first to either end discussion and then vote, or just vote directly. This was a vote to end the discussion, if I'm not mistaken, on the issue. And the Senate voted 92-7 to have no talk about this, this challenge. So that motion was dead from the get-go. 92-7. The vaunted, revered Senate of elitists said 92-7. We are not going to question what happened in Pennsylvania. You can, and that's a Senate with a majority Republican, majority Republicans at that time. And there was no filibuster. So, you know, this thing about the Senate being this place of checks and balances where you can have a filibuster system that will protect us from radical measures was not used at all. So the Senate kind of balked on that and balked on many other things that day. I don't know what would have happened if Miguelito Pence had, had some gonads and done what he had to do. I don't know if the process would have eventually allowed the election, quote, official elections to be overturned with the actual election results. But at least if that had happened, then all these things that have been that happened in the election would have come out to the spotlight, and it would have been much more difficult for the Democrats to demonize what was happening outside that same day on January 6th. So that's the backdrop of the news. Now, what was the news that drew my attention? What happened was that on this past week, there was this bill that had passed through the House of Representatives, and it was proposing the formation of a January 6th commission to study what had happened on January 6th. And obviously this was a McCarthy-esque witch hunt to try to demonize the Democrats' political enemies all the more. So it easily passed the House of Representatives, which has a majority Democrats at the present time, and which is to the shame of America. Even though the elections were stolen, the fact that Americans still voted in enough of these rats into the House is an example, a visible, tangible manifestation of America's stupidity. I mean, that's how stupid this nation is. In even though the elections were stolen, it shouldn't even be close. You know, instead of, it's like a football score that instead of being, and I'm saying soccer, football score of 8-3, let's say that the referee was biased, and instead of 8-3, it was 6-4, let's say. But we still should have won. It shouldn't have even been that close. So the fact that there's so many rats in the House of Representatives is a manifestation of the stupidity of this country. But that aside, the House of Representatives passed this bill, and it went to the Senate. And the Senate filibustered it, and they tried to end the filibuster, and there was a vote, and the vote was for 54-35 to end the filibuster. And because the opposition needs 60% to end the filibuster, then the bill died. So that was the news. And you see it on the surface and you go, oh, this is proof that the filibuster works, that it's that the founding fathers were these 3D chess magicians who wisely, built up this bicameral system where, if one of the houses does one thing wrong, the other house will undo the harm and all that. And yes, it's a good thing that the bill died, but think about it. The vote to end the filibuster was 54-35. I mean, in other words, the majority of people, of senators, wanted the bill to be voted on. In other words, they weren't going to vote for it. They wanted this January 6th commission. And interesting that only 89 senators voted. And if you only count the 89, 54 out of 89 is over 60%, because if you have 90 senators, 60% of 90 is 54, 9 times 6, 54. So more, at least within the 89 who actually voted, they did have more than 60% to end the filibuster and vote for the bill. But because it has to be 60% of the 100 elected senators, then the filibuster, effectively killed the bill. The filibuster couldn't be ended, and the bill could not be voted on. But if you think about it, why did only 89 senators vote? Why did the other 11 abstain on such an important issue? And the reason is because they wanted they really did want to vote for the bill, but they were afraid of their constituents back home. So out of fear, they didn't want to go and overtly vote, for the bill or to end the filibuster. But they didn't want to be on record for having, supported the or ended the filibuster, because they would have faced hell back home. So they chose to abstain. You know, like good cowards, they said, I'm not going to vote because I don't want to jeopardize my political career. And that means, just that alone shows that even though there might have been a majority support for the bill, that it didn't survive the Senate, because the senators in general knew that there was enough opposition to the election results out there for them to get in trouble if they let this thing go through. because this gender sixth commission would have turned into a McCarthy-esque circus. So that's why they filibustered. So now let's evaluate. And I know this clip is running very long, but at least we'll try to get a few ideas in before we split it up and into two clips, and we'll continue in the next clip. But let's just say a few things. The filibuster worked because it was politically expedient to do so. In other words, the senators knew that there was a heavy political price to pay if they let this thing go through. So they just did the charade enough to say, okay, some of us are for the commission, but not enough. And then that's why they filibustered. Why didn't they filibuster back in on January 6th? Why didn't they stand up to the electoral results and say, okay, let's, we have to investigate what's going on? Because when a filibuster involves paying, being brave, and being willing to pay a political price for doing what is right, the senators will never do it. Why not? Because as we said before, the Senate is born out of two things, compromise and elitism. And elite people, noble, when you think of elite, just think of the nobility, the Duke of Edinburgh or whatever, the Duke of whatever, the Earl of whatever. Just think of nobility, these highfalutin people who have this title and this elite power that other people don't have. That's what comprises the word elite. Elite people are not inclined to sacrificing their lives for others because elitists are always in conservation mode. In other words, they, by definition, they're them being elite means that they have a certain clustering of power, accumulation of power that other people don't have. That's what makes them elite. And they stay their whole lives fighting to preserve that power that has been accumulated around them. So they are always in conservation mode. They are never people who are willing to shed their lives and sacrifice for a principle, an idea. Because elitism brings that mindset. You know, how do I preserve the power that has been assigned to me by inheritance or by decree or by maneuvering or whatever? And again, to emphasize the elitism in the Senate, we've talked about this before, but let's go over it again. Why is there an air of elitism around the Senate? First of all, they're all elected to six-year terms. And as opposed to the plebeians in the House of Representatives who are elected to two-year terms. So just there alone, there's this sense of, oh, you know, I'm here for a longer amount of time. I have more power for a longer time. I don't get rotated as easily, as quickly as those plebeians in the House of Commons, the House of Representatives. And then there are only two senators per state, as opposed to the House of Representatives. It has a whole bunch of people per state. It's only two. You know, from Idaho, it's just going to be two guys. From Iowa, two guys. From Hawaii, two guys. From New York, two guys. So, you know, they look at each other and they say, we are the chosen ones. From the entire state, just the two of us. You know, they start singing the Grover Washington song, and just the two of us. And we can, you know, keep the power if we can, just the two of us, you and I. So these people, look at each other and say, we are special, just two. As opposed to the plebeians in the House who have to be, you know, share their authority with a whole bunch of other representatives from the same state. And the other thing is, as we shared before, the Senate is constitutionally the one that has most direct contact with the president. They approve nominations, they do this and the other. So if the president wants to get certain things done based on the Constitution that the founding fathers foolishly wrote up, they have to, you know, pick up the phone and talk to Senator X or Senator Y. If they find out that Senator Y's vote is going to, you know, stop a nomination, they call Senator Y, you know, and say, why are you doing this to me? The president is not calling a representative in the House because he doesn't have to. So all of that begins to create an atmosphere of elitism. The Senate is this house of chosen wise people who have this special connection with the universe that others don't have. And when you create an atmosphere of elitism, you create people who will never, never, never sacrifice their life for a higher cause. And so whenever they do any filibustering or any blocking, it will only be for easy causes. Causes with very limited, political price. And I know that's a thing common in politicians in general, but when you add the elitism element to it, it makes it even worse. So so when people look at the headline and say, oh, a filibuster stopped the January 6th commission, ergo, this proves how wise the founding fathers were in creating a bicameral system. And by the way, the founding fathers did not write in the filibuster into the Constitution. That was just born out of the rules that the founding fathers allowed the senators to write on their own. So it's not a founding father idea, but they allowed it to happen. So if you want to give them credit, by circumstance, then go ahead and give them credit. But if you give them credit, then you have to be aware that it's giving them credit for a very bad idea. Now think about this. And I've been thinking about this example for some reason all this week about a drunk driver. So let's say you have a drunk driver who has a few drinks too many, and he goes behind the wheel and drives, down the street. And there's this young lady crossing the street. This drunk driver doesn't see her. He just keeps on going, and he plows through her and injures her very badly. And she's lying on the ground, bleeding to death. And the drunk driver kind of realizes what he did because he sees the blood on his windscreen, on his windshield. And he goes, oh, my goodness, I think I hit someone. And he looks back, he sees the body of the woman lying there, and then he knows he's in trouble, but he has a little bit of mercy in his heart, so he stops the car, and he picks up his mobile phone, and he calls, 911 or 999 or whatever, the emergency number, and reports anonymously that there's a person, who needs medical attention. And the ambulance comes, and they save her life, but she's permanently paralyzed. And her life is totally shattered because of what happened. That's kind of what happened here with this January 6th commission. Them having to do a filibuster on the January 6th commission should have never happened. If they had stood their ground and done the right thing, they allowed this problem to happen. So now we're congratulating them for making the 911 call to the woman whose life was altered because of what they chose not to do? Are we kidding? If they had stood their ground, even if the voting had not been overturned, if they had stood their ground on January 6th, if Miguelito Pence and his band of elite cowards had done their job, then there would have never been enough political capital, political currency for Stretch Pelosi and Chuckie Schumer to be promoting a January 6th commission bill. That would have never happened. So don't tell me that this is proof that the Senate system works. It's just evidences that it works when it's convenient for them, and it will not work when push comes to shove, which is when it really matters. There should have never been a woman hit by a drunk driver for there to be a need to call 911 or 999 to save her life. So that's the reason why, the example of this this headline only evidences how terrible it is to have a Senate and a filibuster system in the American Constitution. And we'll talk about more about all of this in a future clip, because this clip really ran very long. And I hope that in some way you will have seen how we really, really desperately need to change the current system. Thank you very much.